IDWA. It's higher. I'm going to do some hysterical literature for you today. And I'm going to be reading The Shunned House by H.P. Lovecraft. So here we go. What I heard in my youth about the Shunned House was merely that people died there in alarmingly great numbers. That, I was told, was why the original owners had moved out some 20 years after building the place. It was plainly unhealthy, perhaps because of the dampness and fungus growth in the cellar, the general sickish smell, the drafts in the hallways, or the quality of the well and pump water. These things were bad enough, and these were all that gained belief among the persons whom I knew. Only the notebooks of my antiquarian uncle, Dr. Elihu Whipple, revealed to me at length the darker, vaguer surmises which formed an undercurrent of folklore among old-time servants and humble folk, surmises which never traveled far, and which were largely forgotten when Providence grew to be a metropolis with a shifting modern population. The general fact is that the house was never regarded by the solid part of the community as in any real sense haunted. There were no widespread tales of rattling chains, cold currents of air, extinguished lights, or faces at the window. Extremists sometimes said that the house was unlucky, but that is as far as even they went. What was really beyond a dispute, is that a frightful proportion of persons died there, or more accurately, had died there, since after some peculiar happenings over 60 years ago, the building had become deserted through the sheer impossibility of renting it. These persons were not all cut off suddenly by any one cause. Rather did it seem that their vitality was insidiously sapped, so that each one died the sooner from whatever tendency to weakness he may have naturally had, and those who did not die displayed in varying degree a type of anemia or consumption, and sometimes a decline of the mental faculties, which spoke ill for the salubriousness of the building. Neighboring houses, it must be added, seemed entirely free from the noxious quality. This much I knew before my insistent questioning led my uncle to show me the notes which finally embarked us both on our hideous investigation. In my childhood, the shunned house was vacant, with barren, gnarled, and terrible old trees, long, queerly pale grass, nightmarishly misshapen weeds, in the high terraced yard, where birds never lingered. We boys used to overrun the place, and I can still recall my youthful terror, not only at the morbid strangeness of this sinister vegetation, but at the eldritch atmosphere and odor of the dilapidated house, whose unlocked front door was often entered in quest of shutters. The small paned windows were largely broken, and a nameless air of desolation hung round the precarious paneling, shaky interior shutters, peeling wallpaper, falling plaster, rickety staircases, and such fragments of battered furniture as still remained. The dust and cobwebs added their touch of the fearful, and brave indeed was the boy who would voluntarily ascend the ladder to the attic, a vast raftered length, lighted only by small blinking windows in the gable ends, and filled with a massed wreckage of chests, chairs, and spinning wheels which infinite years of deposit had shrouded and festooned into monstrous and hellish shapes. But after all, the attic, was not the most terrible part of the house. It was the dank, humid cellar which somehow exerted the strongest repulsion on us, even though it was wholly above ground on the street side, with only a thin door and window-pierced brick wall to separate it from the busy sidewalk. We scarcely knew whether to haunt it in spectral fascination or to shun it for the sake of our souls and our sanity. For one thing, the bad odor of the house was strongest there, and for another thing, we did not like the white fungus growths which occasionally sprang up in rainy summer weather from the hard earth floor. Those fungi, grotesquely like the vegetation in the yard outside, were truly horrible in their outlines. Detestable parodies of toadstools and Indian pipes. It was like we had never seen in any other situation. They rotted quickly, and at one stage became slightly phosphorescent, so that nocturnal passers-by sometimes spoke of witch fires glowing behind the broken panes of the spider-spreading windows. We never, even in our wildest Halloween moods, visited this cellar by night, but in some of our daytime visits could detect the phosphorescence, especially when the day was dark and wet. There was also a subtler thing we often thought we detected. A very strange thing, which was, however, merely suggestive at most. I refer to a sort of cloudy whitish pattern on the dirt floor, a vague shifting deposit of mold or nitre, which we sometimes thought we could trace amidst the sparse fungus growths near the huge fireplace of the basement kitchen. Once in a while, it struck us that this patch bore an uncanny resemblance to a doubled-up human figure, though generally no such kinship existed. There was no whitish deposit, whatever. On a certain rainy afternoon when this illusion seemed phenomenally strong, and when, in addition, I had fancied I glimpsed a kind of thin, yellowish, shimmering exhalation rising from the nitrous pattern towards the yawning fireplace, I spoke to my uncle about the matter. He smiled at this odd conceit, but it seemed that his smile was tinged with reminiscence. Later I heard that a similar notion entered into some of the wild ancient tales of the common folk. A notion likewise alluding to ghoulish or wolfish shapes taken by smoke from the great chimney. And queer contours assumed by certain of the sinuous tree roots that thrust their way into the cellar through the loose foundation stones. Chapter 2. Not till my adult years did my uncle set before me the notes and data which he had collected concerning the shunned house. Dr. Wimble was a sane, conservative physician of the old school, and for all of his interest in the place, was not eager to encourage young thoughts towards the abnormal, his own view postulating simply a building and location of markedly unsanitary qualities had nothing to do with abnormality. But he realized that the very picturesqueness which aroused his own interest would, in a boy's fanciful mind, take on all manner of gruesome, imaginative associations. The doctor was a bachelor, a white-haired, clean-shaven, old-fashioned gentleman, and a local historian of note, who had often broken a lance with such controversial guardians of tradition as Sidney S. Rider and Thomas W. Bicknell. He lived with one manservant in a Georgian homestead with knocker and iron-railed steps, balancing eerily on the steep ascent of North Court Street, beside the ancient brick court and colony house where his grandfather, a cousin of that celebrated privateersman Captain Whipple who burned his Majesty's armed schooner Gaspé in 1772, had voted in the legislature on May 4th, 1776 for the independence of the Rhode Island colony. Around him, in the damp, low-ceilinged library, with the musty white paneling, heavy carved over mantel, and small paned white vine-shaded windows, were the relics and records of his ancient family, among which were many dubious allusions to the shunned house in Benefit Street. That pest spot lies not far distant. For Benefit runs ledgewise just above the courthouse along the precipitous hill up which the first settlement climbed. When, in the end, my insistent pestering and maturing years evoked, from my uncle the hoarded lore I sought, there lay before me a strange enough chronicle. Long-winded, statistical, and drearily genealogical as some of the matter was, there ran through it a continuous thread of brooding, tenacious horror and preternatural malevolence, which impressed me even more than it had impressed the good doctor. Separate events fitted together uncannily, and seemingly irrelevant details held minds of hideous possibilities. New and burning curiosity grew in me, compared to which my boyish curiosity was feeble and inchoate. The first revelation led to an exhaustive research, and finally to that shuddering quest which proved so disastrous to myself and mine. For at last, my uncle insisted on joining the search I had commenced, and after a certain night in that house, he did not come away with me. I am lonely without that gentle soul, and his gentle soul whose long years were filled only with honor, virtue, good taste, benevolence, and learning. I have reared a marble urn to his memory in St. John's churchyard, the place that Poe loved, the hidden grove of giant willows on the hill where tombs and headstones huddle quietly between the hoary bulk of the church and the houses and bank walls of Benefit Street. The history of the house, opening amidst a maze of dates, revealed no trace of the sinister, either about its construction or about the prosperous and honorable family who built it. Yet from the first, a taint of calamity, soon increased to boding significance was apparent. My uncle's carefully compiled record began with the building of the structure in 1763 and followed the theme with an unusual amount of detail. The shunned house, it seems, was first inhabited by William Harris and his wife, Ruby Dexter, with their children, Elkanah, born in 1775, Abigail, born in 1757, William Jr., born in 1759, and Ruth, born in 1761. Harris was a substantial merchant and seaman in the West India trade, connected with the firm of Obadiah Brown and his nephews. After Brown's death, in 1761, the new firm of Nicholas Brown and Company made him master of the brick Providence built of 120 tons, thus enabling him to erect the new homestead he had desired ever since his marriage. The site he had chosen, a recently straightened part of the new and fashionable back street, which ran along the side of the hill above a crowded Cheapside, was all wished, and the building did justice to the location. It was the best that moderate means could afford. And Harris hastened to move in before the birth of a fifth child, which the family expected. That child, a boy, came in December, but was stillborn. Nor was any child to be born alive in that house for a century and a half. The next April, sickness occurred among the children, and Abigail and Ruth died before the month was over. Dr. Job Ives diagnosed the trouble as some infantile fever, though others declared it was more of a mere wasting away or decline. It seemed in any event to be contagious. For Hannah Bowen, one of the two servants, died of it in the following June. Eli. Lydia and the other servant constantly complained of weakness and would have returned to his father's farm in Rehoboth, but for a sudden attachment from Double Pierce, who was hired to succeed Hannah. He died the next year, a sad year indeed, since it marked the death of William Harris himself, enfeebled as he was by the climate of Martinique, where his occupation had kept him for considerable periods during the preceding decade. The widowed Roby Harris never recovered from the shock of her husband's death, and the passing of her firstborn Elkanah 2 years later was the final blow to her reason. In 1768, she fell victim to a mild form of insanity. And was thereafter confined to the upper part of the house, her elder maiden sister, Mercy Dexter, having moved in to take charge of the family. Mercy was a plain, raw-boned woman of great strength, but her health visibly declined from the time of her advent.
Was The Shunned House by H.P. Lovecraft.